Meeting will please come to order. This is already our 13th meeting of the 87th session, and Representative Brandon Peterson has looked over the minutes, and in spite of the fact that he's talking about his new baby, and so Representative Peterson moves the minutes of February 15th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much, Representative Peterson, and I hope that baby's doing really well. Today we have a couple of mandate relief bills. I will call them both by that name. The first is reducing mandates for homeschools, and we'll bring to the testifying table for House File 355, Mary Kiffmeyer, Representative Mary Kiffmeyer. Welcome to the committee. And Representative Myra, would you please move House File 55?
Madam Chair, I move House File 355 and recommend it to be passed and referred to Education Finance.
Representative Myra has moved House File 55, recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. I believe, Representative Myra, that Representative Kiffmeyer has an author's amendment to get her bill in order. Would you move that,
yes,
please?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the author's amendment, House File 355A1, be put in the bill in the form that the author wants.
Representative Myra has moved the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted, and 355 is in the form in which Representative Kiffmeyer would like it. Please say your name for the record, Representative Kiffmeyer. Welcome to our record. Excuse me.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Madam Chair. I do not have a copy of that bill or anything at all, either 355 or the amendment either.
Ooh, excuse me. Pages will have to see to that.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who does not have... Again, Representative Kiffmeyer, welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record and proceed to explain what House File 355 tells us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Representative Mary Kiffmeyer, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of a bill that I'm authoring, House File 355. Thank you for taking my amendment, and I have also here with me today John Tuma, who will also introduce himself. But I just wanted to open...
Excuse me, Representative Kiffmeyer. We did not adopt the amendment officially, so Representative Benson, have you gotten a chance to look at it yet?
I have. I will move the amendment for 355.
Representative Myra already did, so we'll vote on it. all those in favor of adopting the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted, and now the bill is in the shape it should be. I thought I did all that before, but we'll still continue, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, members, for me to be able to be here today on a very important bill. I just want to introduce the fact that as a homeschooling mother for 10 years myself, I remember before even this law was in place, and the very first year that we decided to home educate our children, we had four children, and we did nationally norm reference standardized testing twice in the fall and twice in the spring. Nonetheless, we were sent a letter threatened with criminal negligence if we didn't put our children in the public school. It was rather a shock to me, but then I did a little research and found out that parents in a few years before me had actually put in jail. And I'm thinking, is this America, where parents who take an active involvement in their children's lives, that this would actually be happening here in America? Now, we worked with our school superintendent, and we addressed all of his concerns, and he withdrew his complaint. And we had a close working relationship after that. Matter of fact, for 15 years, I taught bread making to the advanced home ec school in my local school. And so we enjoyed working with them and had a very good, strong working relationship. Then the laws were changed and made it much better. But I think in the years since then, the homeschool has proven themselves to be a strong educational part of the system. I think they have shown that they are responsible, that they are diligent, that they work hard, that they are capable of the responsibility, and I think their children indeed do that. Matter of fact, one of my sons graduated with a master's degree, after 8 years of homeschool from Mayo, and in his national test for the nurse anesthetist program, on the national test, he got 100%. Not too bad, Mom, for the efforts that we put in. So mighty pleased with that. So certainly there are other successes around, but I think we have a proven track record now that some of these mandates that might have been put in place at one time, I think are no longer necessary, and the school superintendents as well, and working with the home educators, have also seen that these are folks that are largely able to be responsible and can be trusted to lift some of these mandates. So with that, members, I will allow John Tuma, who is with me here today, to make more of a detailed presentation. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. You were Representative Tuma when I served before.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Tuma, and please say your name for the record and proceed.
My name is John Tuma. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Christian Home Educators, and we were proud to have you in the dog pound, Madam Chair, because I could never forget our Pledge of Allegiance, because you said it so clearly. And we appreciated that. I represent an association that has about 3,000 families as their members. About half of the homeschoolers in the state belong to our organization, so I want to make it very clear, I don't represent all of homeschooling. I'm here as a volunteer. I know many of you know me as a lobbyist for other things, on public safety issues and conservation issues, but I do this as a volunteer. Typically, we don't try to do anything at the legislatures regarding homeschooling. We try to just basically monitor what's going on. But 2 years ago, the superintendents and the school board association, as they often do, were told to go out and find some mandates to reduce, as we've been through this, and I know you're going to be continuing that ongoing struggle to reduce mandates. I wish you the best of luck. It's always a challenge. But on their list of about 50 different things was one little small paragraph saying reduce homeschool reporting. And so I took up the challenge, talked to then Representative Marcia Swales and Senator Jen Olson, who, by the way, interestingly enough, was one of the key negotiators developing the 1987 law. And so for her, this is kind of a full circle as she finishes out her career. She started her career by putting the homeschool law together, and now she is going to simplify it, make it better for all of us. I worked very closely with the Superintendents Association 2 years ago with the, fortunately, Charlie Kite happened to be my former superintendent from Northfield, so I knew Mr. Kite very well. He's not here, but wants to indicate that they support this legislation. Worked closely with him and the School Board Association. We appreciated very much working with their staff, trying to figure out how can we simplify this for all of us. And frankly, I think the law that you have should reduce the paperwork for your local school districts by about 30%, given all the different things that they don't have to do for the homeschoolers. What you'll see with homeschooling since 1987, that has been quite successful. In the handouts you have on the front here, but on the back, you can see that the statistics nationally for homeschooling has been very, very successful. And what you see from these statistics is that, you know what, we're scoring in the 80 percentile in most of the norm reference tests. It doesn't matter what the family's income, the education of the parents, whether they're a certified teacher, how much is spent on the schooling, or the level of state regulation regarding how successful those individuals are. And so that tells you that a lot of the kind of busy work that was created back in 1987 really doesn't provide you with any benefit whatsoever, other than make a lot of school secretaries run around and have to collect a lot of paper that means nothing. And so we tried to work through this legislation to make sense out of the relationship that exists now. When you talk to your superintendents, most of them are not trying to regulate homeschooling. They're actually trying to work with them in a cooperative basis. For example, in Fergus Falls, they had some extra classroom space, and they offer it free to the co-op, not as a part-time class or anything. You just come in, we'll let you use our school. They're communicating with the homeschool co-ops and individuals that are homeschooling, offering services to them. So the relationship has changed, and we figure the law might as well reflect that more cooperative relationship and not have a bunch of busy work and paperwork. I won't go through all the details of the the changes unless you want me to, Madam Chair, but it's pretty self-explanatory. There will be less reporting for those families. superintendents are okay with that. What is a very key component of this, I want you to understand, is that we do not change the mechanism by which to go after, quote unquote, the bad families. Okay, this is not supposed to be a shield for those individuals. It is only a reporting statute. It is a petty misdemeanor. If you don't report correctly, it's just about reporting. The enforcement happens in another section of the law. That enforcement happens in the child protection statutes. And we don't change that. And in some ways, we've enhanced that by working with the county attorney from Ramsey County, who does the main prosecution in child protection cases. And I think if you are concerned about that, if you see on page 3, lines 11 through 14, it talks about us maintaining all of our education records, which we're required to do by law. And if there is a child protection action started, those documents are automatically something that the county attorney can get a hold of. Doesn't have to ask for discovery. And the reason we did that, most traditional homeschool families don't have any problems with this. But in the inner city, as I understand from the Ramsey County attorney and some of the people who do social work, I don't see these families, I don't represent them, but you'll have families that are bad. They're into doing drugs, they're in gangs, the parents are in gangs. It's not a good situation. And a lot of times when the child is getting some pushback from the community services within the school, the parents will go, oh, I'm going to homeschool, and think that somehow that's going to be a shield from this being interfered with. And what this says is, no, if you're going to say that, you better snap to it and show that you have those documentations. In most of those cases, already the child protection action has begun, and the services are trying to be provided for them. And so we wanted to make sure that this didn't act as a shield to that family that is doing something inappropriate. Outside of that, I can say we work with the Department of Education, the Department of Health and Human Services. We work with the Department of Health, Department of Public Safety, and the Department of Labor over the years, just to make sure the changes that we're making here don't cause any problems. And so far, there has been no objections to any of the changes. And like I said, 2 years ago, we worked very closely with those individuals. I've sent this information to all of them again. We've actually made a couple minor changes today in the author's amendment to address some concerns raised by the Department of Health, just to make sure that when someone moves into Minnesota, they provide their immunization records. With that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for any questions on any specifics.
Thank you, Mr. Tuma. Do you have a testifier or two?
I had one. There she is. Sorry.
And while she's coming to the testifying table, I'd like to introduce homeschool students who are in attendance today. They are mostly wearing Boy Scout uniforms, but I'd like them to stand as well as the parent and say your names for us and perhaps even what rank you've achieved in your Boy Scout pursuit. And I think you're trying for Eagle Scout, is that correct? And next?
I'm Kane Hetz, and I'm the first class. I'm Peter Weber, and I'm second class.
I'm Josh
Kennedy,
and I'm first class.
I'm Josh
Weber,
and
I'm first class.
I'm Pat Weber,
and
we're 206 a month.
And all of you are part of a homeschool group or separate? Is it three different homeschool groups? Thank you very much.
And John's just struggling between whether to become an astronaut or a legislator, so I don't know.
Oh, dear. I would say the former might be your goal. And, gentlemen, did any one of you want to say something about your homeschool experience? Please come to the table if you'd like to say a few words. Be brave. Okay, thank you very much. Welcome to the testifying table, ma'am, and say your name for the record and proceed.
Laura Wearing.
And please proceed with your testimony.
Well, I just wanted to tell you that homeschooling, it's just been a wonderful experience. I'm married. We have four children, almost 16, 14, those are girls, 12-year-old boy, and a 10-year-old girl. And we have simply enjoyed it. In fact, my kids are just writing some autobiographies, and my son was saying how much he is excited. One thing we've done through the years is we've read a lot ever since the kids were very small, and lots of reading, and then, you know, they go into reading. But that's the way you really find out about a lot of things. Sometimes, you know, they might read the history encyclopedia too. It's like, okay. But there's so many resources available for homeschoolers. It's an absolutely wonderful and exciting way to live. For us, it is like education's a way of life. For some people, they might just say, okay, school's just between these hours and these hours. And even though we homeschool, our children have homework. But they have deadlines. They have research papers. They have reports. I guess many homeschoolers are very competitive. So people want to be on the cutting edge of the latest kind of curriculum, or whether it's math, a new math program you do on the computer, or something else. So we share information all the time. I belong to a couple different co-ops. One's a sports. We have science and writing. And I could really tell you many things. One of our ways we love to learn is through a unit study. And that way we're learning everything from the subject matter, whether it's history, and then there's science involved, math, reasoning, life skills. And one thing I wanted to tell you is how much we support this legislation. I think it's also very important, as Mr. Tuma said, that people that might want to pretend they're homeschooling, it shouldn't be allowed. It's not good for them. It's not good for our community. It's not good for our society. And so there should be ways to help them stop doing what they're doing and put them on the right path. And I think that's good. I like the fact that, although I think there are some homeschoolers that wouldn't be popular with the fact that giving up that $80 per student per year, because for most homeschoolers, we spend a lot of money. I mean, I basically have a library at home, but our kids, we frequent many libraries as well, and the librarians know them by name. But so we buy a lot of materials. We might try something, oh, we don't like this, but so there's no, the $80 is like, okay, we can pass that up. I think it's a wonderful way to save the superintendents, who I don't really know all of the job that they do, but for them to have to look over, you know, thousands of homeschoolers as well, it's kind of like not very nice, because they already have their job. It's like they have this big extra heap of job to do. So
thank you, Ms. Waring. Thank you for sharing that with us. And we have some questions now. Representative Carlson.
Yes, Madam Chair. My question is of Mr. Tuma. I'm like you, tempted to say Representative Tuma as well. He used to serve on this committee.
And you were a fine chair, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you. A question I have, I'm looking at a handout here, and you referenced the Department of Health and the immunization. And the handout says streamlining record keeping of immunization records for school districts and families. And then our summary says that it strikes the language requiring a school superintendent to keep immunization records. And I was on the health care committee, or Health and Human Services Committee, when this legislation was passed first for K-12 students, and then later for even college students, because we had some counties and some neighborhoods in the eyes of the Department of Health that were dangerously low in terms of the number of young people who were properly immunized. And then there was a language put in, you know, for religious reasons or whatever, somebody chose not to be immunized, they didn't have to. But it's just not clear to me now what's happening there with the references of striking the language. And I guess my basic question is, is there any record keeping done then to ensure that proper immunization is done? Because apparently the superintendent would no longer keep the record.
Representative Carlson and Mr. Tuma, I think that Lisa Larson would like to clarify something in the summary. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, in fact, what's being done here is that the requirement is being changed so that there's no longer requirement for the superintendent to keep annual immunized records. But they do come in, as I see, and you can see from the language, twice in the course of a homeschool career.
And Madam Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, that's correct. Actually, what we found out in the process is the Department of Health only wants to get those records at those two times. And so what was happening is our homeschoolers were sending in immunization records on an annual basis, but in reality, they only require the reporting from the school districts when the child first starts school and when the child reaches grade 7 age. And so basically what this does is reflect what the actual practice was. But for a lot of our homeschool moms, they were going to their doctors every year, getting their immunization records and sending them in and cluttering up the paperwork. And so what this does is tries to reflect the actual practice. In the author's amendment that was put on today, we also reference, it's kind of obscure, but it says reference section 12 of that statute. And the reason for that references back to their rules, which allows them to adjust based on any new coming threats that are out there. And so we're trying to make sure that they still have the same power that they have presently, and the law reflects what they are actually doing today. And so in reality, we're really not reducing the requirement from the health department standpoint, so they really don't have any fiscal note here, but we're helping that school district not have to collect paperwork on an annual basis when they don't need to.
Madam Chair, that explains it. I just remember the testimony at the time we had those bills, wanted to make sure that we weren't doing something that we'd feel sorry for later. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. That was a good point to make. Representative Myra.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, Mr. Tuma, this sounds like a win-win-win. First, it's a win for the superintendents because they don't have to ask.
Representative Myra, do you have your microphone in front of you?
I do. Thank you. All right, thank you. It seems like a win for the superintendents because they don't have to collect information that isn't looked at, and a win for the homeschooling parents because they don't have to annually supply information that is, you know, it just streams like the whole process. It also is a win for the state. I understand that through this bill there is a reduction in the amount of aid to non-public pupils. Do we have a fiscal note on that or have an estimate of how much savings would be for the state?
Mr. Tuma.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we do have a fiscal note. I didn't go into it in detail, but it's about $1 million on an annual basis that you're saving. And you know, I just wanted to point out, I didn't go into it in detail here because it will probably address in the Finance Committee. You know, the homeschool community is giving up an $80 textbook aid. There's also availability for counseling aid and for health services aid. Very rarely used. About a quarter of the homeschool families use the textbook aid. We actually kind of fell into that. I don't think it was really thought of back in 87 when they created the law. But how they regulated us, they just added a couple sentences on the bottom of the private school law. So we're considered a non-public school, no different than Breck or St. Teresa's Catholic School. And so because of that, we're able to submit reports for that aid. And it is a sacrifice. Like I said, this is a compromise piece of legislation. This is not the first thing that we came up and said, please take this from us. You know, if you want to pay me for all the money I'm saving you from not sending my kids to school, I'd be glad you to send me the check, but I know that's not going to probably happen anytime in the near future. But what we were told from the superintendents, this was the one area from a mandate perspective that is most difficult for them to administer. When St. Teresa's comes and requests textbooks, they have come with 100 students in one request, already all everything filled out, and they usually ask for only a set of textbooks, say all math textbooks 1 year, and next year maybe all social studies. When our homeschool moms, we love them, but they love their kids, and like they said, they're very innovative, and they come with 100 different requests, all from curriculum providers that are probably not even known to by the public schools, because we do have a very vibrant curriculum market out there that markets directly to homeschoolers, and this creates a lot of confusion and complication for those school districts. So it was a sacrifice for us, but our superintendents told us that was the biggest headache they had administering that program, and so we felt that if we're going to be true about our word of reducing the mandates and doing our service to the state, that we had to put that on the table. And so that's there. So that's the win for the state, and we certainly will go in more details on the fiscal savings at the next committee.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the information and the knowledge around homeschooling, which I don't know much about. And I just like to say that the stats are great, so I just love the fact that have some good reporting around homeschooling. I definitely love the fact that we will be saving the state money. But I have a couple of questions I would like to ask, because I heard you state that by doing this, one of the things you will be doing will be reducing the paperwork, which is, you know, it's always a bunch of paperwork. And also it'd be less reporting. And so I'm trying to see whether by reducing the reporting, reducing the mandates and regulation, would that cause an impact on these great stats from being different from what they were? Are the stats so good because of the mandates and the reporting requirements? And how can we stop those who are pretending to homeschool if we don't have those mandates in place?
Mr. Tuma.
And Madam Chair and Representative Moran, very good questions. I would point you on the handout we had there, the last point down here, it talks about state regulations. And so the researcher broke this down and said, okay, if we're in a high regulation, we are a high regulated state in Minnesota, compared to, say, a low regulation state like in Texas, where they just basically send a letter when they start homeschooling and that's it. How does it compare? And the statistics are, not at all. They're all the same, basic 87, 88, 87 for a high, low, medium regulation state. So the regulation around reporting really has no insignificant impact on the performance mm-hmm. of schooling. Now, it's a good question about those who pretend and how do we deal with that. And when I was chair of the crime committee, it was the public defenders from Hennepin County and then county attorney Amy Klobuchar who approached us to change how we focus on those truant kids, those ones that are in trouble, are having problems, they probably don't have that parental structure that they need. How do we deal with them effectively, not just from a homeschool perspective, but just literally from those kids struggling? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we did at that time was create this as a petty misdemeanor. So this is not a crime anymore that we deal with, because what was unfortunately happening because of that is that you had to get too many lawyers playing around and not have a focus on the child, mm-hmm. and it became a crime. And so it was a misdemeanor at that time, and we dealt with it as a crime. Mm-hmm. And it was interfering with where they really wanted to go, and that was child protection. Mm-hmm. And so that was why we make this connection. Granted, this reporting statute establishes the standards for the child protection statutes that you have to educate your children, but we want to get into child protection first and foremost, and that's where Hennepin County and Ramsey County do their work with those troubled youth, whether the parents are trying to fake homeschooling or whether they're just not connecting with them. That's what most of the problem is. It's very rare that the parent will try that, but we didn't want to interfere with the statute that they're actually using, which is the child protection statutes. And so we don't do that, we don't change that, and actually back in 2001, when we dealt with that, we actually enhanced it and strengthened those statutes so that districts could have these kind of intervention programs that Hennepin County, and I know Ramsey County has since instituted one of those.
Representative Moran.
And one last question. So are we to assume that you only have problems with homeschooling in Ramsey and Hennepin County?
Mr. Tuma.
Is that the assumption?
No, Madam Chair. No. It is not a problem. This is, we're on the edges of what criminal creative people try to dream up, okay? Mm-hmm. It is not the common tool that the bad people are using. Some people sometimes will dream it up on occasion, but we make sure that that is not going to happen. And that's what we're trying
Madam
to do.
Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer. Thank you. I'd like to address this issue as well. Thank you, Representative Moran, for your question and all that. Actually, when you do regulations that make time to be spent by the homeschooling parents and the superintendent, you take away from their ability to do the functions of teaching. So actually, those kinds of regulations, hinder that kind of very goal that we want to have, is spend our time on educating. And then take those situations, and I think it's just that where you have more population, you statistically will have more issues. So it's not a matter of those two counties, but lower population counties, of course, will have less. High population are statistically apt to have more, and that's all that is a function of, not at all anything more. And I think because of that quantity issue, we tend to work closely with them because we want to make sure that the laws that protect us, that allow us to freely exercise our right of choice, and we support other parents and their choices and what they make as we fight for ours as well, that we don't want to have those misused. And so we do work closely and do support that. But putting regulations on superintendents or us or others who are properly homeschooling only takes away from what the time the kids need.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the House Research Bill Summary, Representative Kiffmeyer, and I'm looking at item 5, where it talks about providing services for guidance counseling services. And just have a couple of quick questions. One of them, just generally, the use of 15 students. I'm just wondering how you arrived at that particular number. And then I have a follow-up question, if I could.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Representative. I think that as the oldest of 14 kids, maybe the number 15 was just in case my parents would have chosen that we had that. But, on the other hand, Mr. Tuma can maybe give some more details as to the number.
Mr. Tuma.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, good question. Me and Charlie Kite pulled it out of our head saying it would be pretty hard for a homeschool mom to have 15 kids to fit within the time frame in which they can qualify for those services. And so that's where the number came from. It's not magical.
Okay.
We've talked about 10. We've talked about 20. I would want to be very careful with you. We do pick up some what we would consider traditional private schools, very few of them, about 30 of them apparently someplace out there. Talking to those who represent the private schools, they don't know who they are. No one has ever contacted them. We don't know, understand who they are. So theoretically, there is some quote-unquote non-homeschools that would lose the opportunity to participate in this aid program. So it probably is not the perfect way to regulate, but in talking to the private schools, they didn't see that that was a big issue for them. They are concerned that, because obviously you guys can come back next year and say 25 or 50 just to save money. So I want to put that on the table. They are concerned about this, but they're not opposing what we're doing.
Representative Benson.
Good, Madam Chair. Well, I was wondering, I come from a family of only 5, so I thought, maybe there are families joining together here, coming together with their children in somebody's home. But the other question has to do with obligating school districts upon request to provide guidance counseling services. Now, in the bill we're about to hear, there is a proposal to eliminate maintenance of effort. And the last numbers I saw having to do with school counseling services is that about one-third of all the schools in the state of Minnesota no longer have any counselors at all. And Minnesota is sitting 49th out of 50 states now in student-counselor ratios with students, something over 700. So I'm just wondering, how do you see the schools fulfilling this obligation if they, in fact, themselves have no counselors?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Benson. Well, this exempts the school districts from providing that service to the 15 or less, so this actually saves them and helps them. And in regards to most homeschoolers as well, they do seek guidance and counseling and advice in a variety of ways. They're very, very active, very innovative, very active and engaged and involved. So this is less of a service that they generally use in any respect, but in this bill it would actually lift that mandate requirement from the school district, so it would actually help them.
Well, Madam Chair, then I'll probably leave that question to the next bill author. Thank you.
Happy to have the next question, yes. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Tuma, or Representative Kiffmeyer, or the testifier. I always, we've had, as I'm sure most, a lot of people here know, we had this bill last year, and I continue to have my same struggles with it as I had have before. You know, whenever we have testifiers here regarding homeschooling, or when families visit legislators who are homeschooling, we always have the A-plus examples, you know, the scouts in the audience, the testifier here. And I know that I've seen statistics about the number of, you know, scholars who do really well in various recognitions, national merit and so forth, that kids who are homeschooled, and, you know, the old Plato model of one-to-one teaching, or was that Socrates anyway, that's the best and highest way to learn one-on-one. And who but the parent would be the best teacher? I'm a power to the parent, parent advocate always. But I always, when this legislation went through in the first place, which was before my time even, but I followed it, lobbying for the League of Women Voters, I've always been glad that we're a high regulation state here in Minnesota with homeschoolers, because for things like compulsory attendance, we are a very strong state. Representative Mariani is even trying to make us a stronger state in that regard with our 17 and 18-year-olds, and we would all like to do that on the day that we come up with the money to enforce it. But the idea that that we would stop enforcing it, at least with the shred of enforcement that we have with having it be an obligation now in current law of school superintendents, but it's my reading of this on page 3 of the bill that we are no longer, the law must be followed, but the superintendent isn't the one any longer that's enforcing it. And that's always been my concern about homeschooling, is the bad actors who wouldn't show up here at the Capitol. And I have not ever had a lot of evidence that there are examples like that, but but we've always worried about that. And so I, like Representative Moran, wonder if the reason we don't have those bad examples is because of our good regulations. And everybody would like to not have responsibilities. The superintendents are under siege, I'm sure, or turning in needless reports and things. But I think this bill goes too far for me to be able to support it in the opposite direction. And I'm wondering if what you could say to me. And to me, the biggest concern is the compulsory attendance in here. And then my other question, which is just a more factual question. What is the change that you're looking for on page 1, by having the nationally recognized college entrance exam instead of the current law?
Mr. Tuma.
Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, good questions. That is a situation where you have a 15-year-old who's taken the ACT. That's what my son did, and we submitted that to our superintendent as the test we're using. But I've been told that theoretically the ACT does not qualify as a national norm reference test. So that's what we were told. Us and our superintendents get along fine, so it's not an issue. That's what we submitted as a test. And we figure that if a student's taking the a ACT college entrance exam, or the plan test, those type of tests, that should be able to qualify as meeting the requirements. And so instead of having to take also the Iowa Basic at that same year. So that was the purpose of that. I understand where you're coming from, Representative Greiling. At best, those who categorize those high, medium, and low regulations would put us now under this law as a medium regulation state. And so what our hope was to literally reduce the paperwork, but not create an environment where we're in the Wild West, okay? And you know, like some states like Texas, where they just, you know, you send in a letter and that's all you have to do for the length of it. We made very clear here that they're still annually reporting to the district. We simplify that reporting, hopefully, so that they can do it electronically. Like when we fill out our campaign finance reports, we go on electronically and fill in the data and certify that that's who we are. it'd be nice for that school to be able to create a system where you just go in and say, check, no change, on an annual basis. And so we're trying to do a lot of those things. I understand where you're coming from. There are bad people out there. There are bad people in a lot of walks of life. Having been the crime chair, I know that. And it's not. We want to make sure that we're not doing any harm to those statutes where they're actually doing the work to protect the children who are around bad parents. So we didn't do that. We didn't change that. And this reporting, I don't think, is going to modify their ability to do their work in the area that they're doing it, which is child protection.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is a little different than some of the others, and it has to do with the transportation section of the bill. Having carried a number of transportation-related, particularly child-related issues, I'm wondering, given that this is changing, there's still going to be permission given, but the permission is just on the parent's word. And while it looks like you're adding application to the offenses, I'm wondering then if you've if this will be vetted by the Transportation Committee, given these changes to the commissioner's job.
Representative Kiffmeyer or Mr. Tuma, who would like to address that?
Are you ready?
Yep.
Mr. Tuma.
Yep. Madam Chair and Representative Norton, I have not talked to the Transportation Chair yet. When we talked about this 2 years ago when the bill came through, again, different chair now, but they did not want to see it. That was the case in the Senate. I have talked to the public safety and the health and the jobs, excuse me, the jobs chair, because there's a change in the Department of Labor and Industry regulations. They don't want to see it. So between now and it's going to the Education Finance Committee, I'll hopefully have a chance to talk to those chairs to make sure that they don't necessarily want to see it. Regarding the change, this is something we worked out very closely with the Department of Public Safety. Right now, the way it works is I can go to my superintendent and get a letter, okay? He has to then go back and check his records to see, yes, I'm homeschooling. I get that letter from him. I take that letter, and I send it in with my pack to do, and homeschoolers are the only ones allowed to do correspondence school in Minnesota. And the reason for us going and get that letter was because those who do this kind of teaching wanted to make sure it was very narrow of those who can actually access this privilege to take it correspondingly. In talking to the department, they never double-checked those records. Okay, I mean, they just got the letter. So, I mean, if I was a nefarious, wanted to break the law, okay, I could go and just copy a letter from the letterhead I get from my superintendent every year when they send me my package and say, I'm homeschooling. No one's doing that, and frankly, no one's checking with the superintendent. So what we tried to do is create that same structure without me having to walk and go bother the superintendent when I wanted to get that document. So I certify that I'm homeschooling, okay? And I certify, and on the application it will say it is a crime if I lie, okay? Which is much more notice of the violation than presently is in law today. And then we also make it very clear that the department can go get our records from the superintendent. Right now our records are private records, so we make it clear in here that for this specific purpose, if the department wants to audit to make sure that homeschoolers aren't out there breaking the law, they can audit that by contacting the school district and asking for proof that the family has been submitting their reports on an annual basis. And so from a practical purpose, it's no different. We just save the superintendent the headache of having to do a letter for all the homeschool families that are using this service.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have what I think is more of a comment than a question, but I certainly would appreciate a response if you have one. I think it's Title I of the U.S. Code. It might be Title V, but one of the titles in our U.S. laws states that parents are the ultimate authority over their kids' education, and so everything else would be subservient to that. I think that's important to understand. And also, in running for office, I made a comment one time in a public place and said that our Constitution, Minnesota Constitution, did not even address the issue of education. While I was technically correct, it actually talks about a uniform system of public schools. And I think that's important to note as well. And it talks about the legislature shall make such provisions by taxation or otherwise that will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools throughout the state. Now, we certainly have laws and regulations dealing with non-public schools, and those are appropriate as well. But I think I support very strongly the goal and the freedom of parents to teach their kids as they see fit. I come from a public school background, public college. My kids go to public school. My wife is a public school teacher, and my sister is a public school teacher as well. But I have many friends who are homeschool, and they've done that for a long time, and I've been tangentially a part of that for many years, asking a lot of questions about why and the purpose. And I found that for the most part, these parents are just strongly committed to their kids and doing what's best for their kids. They're not doing it out of any other thing than they feel they have a right, and they feel they can teach their kids in the best possible way given who their children are. And so over the years, I've come to understand and realize how important these parents are, and I commend them very much for choosing that. I honestly could not do it myself. I could not do it. It's so hard, and you do it every day, and I commend that, and I just want to let you know I support you based on what I believe our Constitution tells me. So thank you very much.
Representative Kiffmeyer. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Barrett. I appreciate your good comments, and I think that's a lot of the experience. Matter of fact, if the public school situation had the statistics that the homeschools do have and the proof to show, it would be something I would say sometimes that questions ought to be asked of those homeschooling parents. You know, what's the secret to that? But I think it is a tremendous commitment and a tremendous time that they do put in. The big thing is that don't burden the 99.9% who are doing it right with all the regulations that you're trying to get after that small element. We need to separate those two. And so we already do have laws, whether Mr. Tuma has already talked about in regards to taking care of that. We have that concern as well, okay? But let's not burden those who are. And by the way, I stand with every single one of you in your right to choose public school. Matter of fact, my taxes go to help you. And whereas I take on the extra responsibility and cost at making the choice that I do, and I'm glad to have that. I just ask for the freedom and the ability to do so without unnecessary intrusion into the efforts and the work that is done by these homeschoolers. So with that, Madam Chair, those are my comments for just right now.
Thank you. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what's going on over here? I truly believe that most parents are good parents, and parents are definitely the first teachers of their children, and that we have to see parents in that way, wanting to do the best and be the best that they can be. I think that about all parents. They want to be, and they are, and they can be. But just looking at some of the things that helped me understand this bill, because we're passing a law that's going to impact a lot of families. So some of the things that may happen that you want to happen within this bill is to eliminate the requirement that certain circumstances the child would be assessed in subject areas, and that a parent So it eliminates the requirement that in certain circumstances that a child to be assessed in all subject areas, right? It eliminates that. It's going to eliminate the obligation for school districts to provide educational materials because parents would not need the assistance from the school. It's all going to allow homeschool parents to issue an employment certification for a 14-15-year-old to work without bothering a superintendent or anyone else, and it repeals the ability for a superintendent to make an on-site visit to a home or school. And on that last note, if it eliminates a superintendent, who is going to oversight that? That's one question that you can answer. Anyone can answer that one.
Madam Chair and
Mr. Tuba
and Representative Moran. Social services. I mean, that's what's happening now. Superintendents aren't making these annual visits. What they do, if they recognize or suspect something going on, they're not social workers, okay? And they know that. And so they give it to the professionals. And so that's why this was part of what they recommended, okay? And so what they're doing is they want the professionals to do that. And as mandatory reporters, if they suspect something going on, they will report. I've watched cases involving homeschoolers nationally, and most of the time those cases are already on the radar screen. Actually, all the cases are already on the radar screen of social services to deal with. Those are the professionals. We don't change that. That is where the work is being done presently, and the change of this law is not going to have one effect on what's going on in those counties that have aggressive truancy activities in their school districts. This is not affecting that work. We stay away from. You have to understand, there's a whole separate truancy section within the child protection statute that deal with those situations, and we're not changing that. This is simply paperwork.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Moran,
you use words like, you know, bothering the superintendent, you know, being a headache to the superintendent. Superintendent's not paying attention, and maybe that's true. I don't know, because I don't know if there are any here to testify that this is really cumbersome for them and for the parents who homeschooling. So is that an accurate maybe feel for what the superintendents are feeling?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Tuma.
I can't speak for them. I know Mr. Kite is not here, but these are the conversations that we have. That their focus is on their public school, and so that's what their job is. That's frankly, if my superintendent was going around and making annual visits in my district, I'd be calling my school board members up and saying, have him focus on the problems that he should be focusing on, and that is the public schools. Superintendents are not ignoring us, though. I don't want to create that impression that they're not paying attention to what we're doing. They are very much. I get a letter every year. I actually get a few letters every year from them saying, please come in. We have this nice program. Have your school's kids come in. They talk to our co-op groups. They talk to our families. They want us to participate. They're making those opportunities available. They recognize that this is not how it happens through paperwork. Okay, maybe that was the dream back in 87. It didn't work, and most of them have long since figured that out, that the way to deal with this is call us up, send us a letter, invite us, create an opportunity. Come in and have cookies and sit down with us. Let's talk about the programs that we have. That's what's happening in most of the districts in the state of Minnesota right now. They don't want to feel like they're the regulator. There's a different set of places for that to be dealt with in the statutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe there are others in the audience who would like to speak for or against the House File 355. Please come forward to make your statements.
Thank you.
Please
Madam
say your name for the record and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dosland, and I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Charlie Kite is not here today. We did work on this language with Mr. Tuma, and I am happy to follow up with any of the members, Representative Greiling and Representative Moran, who had questions when Charlie returns.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dosland. Are there others who would like to testify for or against House File 355? Please say your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Carla Andros. I'm a home educator in St. Francis. I have three children that I currently teach at home. I'm unhappy with the provision in the House File 355 that eliminates the non-public pupil aid. We are a low-income family. That aid is important to a quality in our education that I can provide for my children. It's also important to other Minnesotans, since almost 5,900 parents applied for that aid last year out of approximately 17,000 home educating families in the state. That is a significant number who need the aid. This aid makes a huge difference in my household when we're educating special needs children. It makes a difference between boring textbooks and interesting alternative curriculum. Special needs children and students often need different ways to learn other than textbooks and seat work. This can be cost prohibited when you're a lower income family. Being able to buy an interactive globe, puzzles, Geo Safari, and other things has made the difference for my son. If I don't have to spend the dollars on educational supplies, then I can use it for groceries. We truly are that strapped for money. I'm frugal, and I raise a large garden. The per pupil aid is a significant amount of money in our household. I can see how many people do not understand that that small amount of aid of $75 per pupil may not seem like a lot, but to us, it makes a real difference. I know I'm not the only person out there who's struggling in this economy. They may not be able to afford the gas and the parking to testify here today, but my friend brought me so that I could come. Everyone doesn't have a strong network to support them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Would you spell your last name so we have it correct for the record?
A-N-D-R-U-S.
Very good. We were just one vowel off. We had O-S up here, but U-S. Thank you very much, Carla, Mrs. Andros. There are others. Mr. Field? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and please proceed.
Can you hear me?
Just speak toward the microphone.
Oh, okay. Hi, my name is James Field. I'm the president of the Minnesota Independent School Forum, and I would like to bring some information, so not speaking before or against this. I also chair and have for 15 years the Non-Public Education Council that reports to the commissioner and is a part of the Department of Education. So I'd like to bring a couple cautions and some information. First of all, in terms of the non-public education committee that has three representatives on it from homeschools, this has not been on the agenda, and the council hasn't had an opportunity to look at this. We do have a meeting on March 4th, and I've asked for this to be on the agenda, that March 4th meeting. I'd also like to throw in a caution on the 15 or below students. And I have here, and Madam Chair, I gave you a copy of this before the meeting. This is the list of the schools that are on the department website with 15 students or less. I think most of these are consider themselves non-public schools, not homeschooled. If I could just cite a couple, there's a Seventh-day Adventist school in Detroit Lakes. It's probably in the church basement. They have seven students. They're a very important feeder to the two Seventh-day Adventist high schools in the state. Because I know that school. And there's some other ones. Lake Country Christian School has 15. There's two schools on here with 15 students. And most of them, Trinity Lutheran in Fergus Falls is probably a feeder to the Fergus Falls High School, Hillcrest Academy. And so I would caution the language in the law with the 15 or less, and maybe there's a different way to get at that. And so I just offer that information. I got one more quick one. It was brought up about the parents' right to educate the children the way they feel right. That actually is a quote from the Pierce decision in 1925 at the Supreme Court. And Mr. Pierce was the governor of Oregon, and he ran on a ticket with support from the Ku Klux Klan, and his platform was to demand that all children in Oregon don't get a high school diploma unless they graduate from a public school. And there was a nun school and a military academy and a Jewish school that brought that all the way to the Supreme Court. And that quote is that the parents have the grave responsibility and right to educate their children the way they wish. And that's been quoted many times. People might remember about 8 years ago there was grandparents that sued their children because they wouldn't let the children come over to the grandparents' house. Well, the children won that, and that quote was there again. That's their responsibility. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Field, and you've raised some very important points.
Madam Chair?
Representative Dabney, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you have a question for Mr. Field?
I've got a request for you.
Sure.
Could all of the committee members get the list that...
Absolutely, we can have the pages copy it, yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Field, would you provide that to the pages or to a page? So that can be copied. Thank you. Ms. Van Gorin, right?
Correct.
Please say your name for the record and proceed.
I'm Pam Van Gorin. I am from Minnetonka. and I began with my husband home educating our children in 1977. And this particular bit of legislation, I find interesting to have it come this circle. I monitored all of the task force meetings that resulted in the law that is being modified this morning, and I applaud most of these changes. This was done, the language came about as a joint commission of public, private, and homeschool interests to work out what we had at that time, an unconstitutional law that said private school was to be essentially equivalent to public school, and what on earth did that mean? The question Representative Moran was asking about the superintendent visits, I would just clarify that our current law reflects what was happening in the mid-80s, where there were only, I think, five other states that had legalized home education, recognized it. One of those was the state of Washington, which is my home state and where my family has been state level to county to classroom level educators. Family holidays were meetings of the State Board of Education, more or less. And so they had just done a two-year survey of home education. And it was the result of that report and their law that came to this state. They did not ask for superintendent visits. That was a request, a deal breaker with one superintendent who was on the task force. And that district no longer requires those things. They actually went out and rehired a retired principal to do all of that work for them until it just simply became too expensive. And he said, this is ridiculous. These families are doing a good job. Mm-hmm. I do have a concern about the provision, eliminating the provision for per pupil aid. In 1975, the legislature passed what is now Minnesota Statute 123B.40, and this is the declaration of policy for the provision that you are proposing to modify today. And it reads, it is the intent of the legislature to provide for distribution of education aids such as textbooks, standardized tests, and pupil support services so that every school pupil in the state will share equitably in education benefits and therefore assure all Minnesota pupils and their parents freedom of choice in education. This statement was a foundation when we passed the Education Tax Credit Bill in 1997. It has been cited in other school choice things across the country. It stood a number of court challenges. I question the propriety of taking one class out of the larger class, and especially when it extends to group schools, not just homeschools. It is a sacrifice that is, I think, that is an unintended consequence to all of it. So I would respond to any questions. Just so you know, the four kids all grew up. Most of them have graduate degrees, and some of them are homeschooling the kids that they have their school age.
Thank you, Mrs. Van Goren.
And Madam Chair.
Mr. Tuma.
You know, Charlie Kite and I are open to discussion. This law has been out there for 2 years, just so everybody knows. It's not been a surprise. It actually was in the omnibus bill in the Senate 2 years ago. It was in play last year. So I'm open to talk to Mr. Fields and anybody who might have a different way to approach this. This was the way we came up with, and anybody wants to talk to us, I'm more than willing, and I've said that when we first presented this law. It looked nothing like when it was presented to Carlos Mariani's committee. And through his leadership, we were able to sit down and work with different folks to get things done correctly. So if someone has a better way of doing it, we're more than willing and want to do that. I understand it's a sacrifice. This is not my first choice. It was not what I put out there. It is what we worked out in a cooperative way with the superintendents. We understand the struggle that this can be for them to administer. And so we want to honor their request, and I'll definitely talk with Mr. Kite between now and finance or before this goes to the floor, and anybody else who wants to talk to me about a better way to deal with it. And if you want to give me more money, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chuma, and thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Mrs. Van Goren.
One further comment, too. Mr. Chuma's favorable wish to discuss this further. Mr. Field is chair of the Minnesota Non-Public Education Council, and among the duties of that council, and we are looking now at Minnesota Statute 123B.445, a parent or guardian of a non-public school pupil or non-public school may file a complaint about services provided under, and they are talking about the per pupil aid, et cetera. This has not come to the council probably because of that parent or guardian qualifier. But properly, this is the body that should be hearing questions about how this is happening or not happening or the burden. And so I would propose a lemonade solution here to this problem, that you refer it to the Non-Public Ed Council and let them do their work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Van Goren. Are there others who would like to testify for or against House File 355 as amended? If not, Representative Kiffmeyer, closing remarks.
Thank you,
Excuse me,
Chair.
Representative Mariani has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I certainly didn't want to speak after the author of the bill was able to make her closing comments. I just want to echo, and in the spirit of what former Representative Tuma just expressed, I do want to echo for the members here, in particular for the author of this bill, to indeed proceed pretty judiciously and proceed with a pretty open mind. This bill has been around here for several years. It does evoke some pretty strong passions. And one of the things that I've benefited from this bill, frankly, is just learning just how good many of our home school parents and students, what a good experience that seems to be. However, I do want to caution members here, and I hope we're not establishing a new principle here. When we first got together as a committee, we pretty much on both sides of the aisle said that the most strongest guiding principle for us is student first. And today, I heard a slight variation or a slight departure from that. What I heard, members, was parents first. And believe me, I do not want to get into public debate about trying to put parents above students or vice versa. But I just want us to be really, really careful here. I think the language that Representative Greiling and Mr. Tuma, you and I have spoken about this. The language that Representative Greiling pointed out in terms of the reporting function of the superintendent leaves me a little worried, because at the end of the day, if the parent isn't standing up for the student, and we all know that does happen, maybe it only happens to 0.1% of the time, but it only takes one student, one human being, to be put on a bad path, maybe even a harmful path. Later we're standing around asking, well, who was standing up for that individual, for that citizen of our state? And so that's why I suspect, the language before us in statute is structured in such a way where you've got this kind of balance between, a transparency balance in terms of reporting, in terms of engaging responsible people who have a public charge to be able to make transparent to the public the existence and the quality of the education of every student. And I understand what you're trying to do, and I think you're approaching it not from an ideological perspective. I think you're approaching it from a common sense perspective, but we clearly start pushing up against some pretty important ideological conflicts here. And so I just want to encourage you to keep that in mind as you move forward, if you move forward with this bill, and as you engage the executive branch, to be able to make sure that at the end you've got a well-balanced piece of legislation that doesn't trump the right and the freedom of a young student by the freedom of any of the adults out in society, and quite frankly, including our parents. And so I'm struggling with this bill. Mr. Tuma, you know that. I've been struggling with this bill for years. We did pass along certain provisions of this bill last year onto the omnibus bill. We're taking, I think, you know, sort of cautionary step by step. Perhaps we're ready to take bigger steps. I'm just looking for some really strong assurances that what at the end is motivating this and what winds up being in statute isn't in fact putting students second, but frankly is always about putting students first.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Representative Kiffmeyer, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and to Representative Mariani. The whole point of home educating is exactly that, students first. And we put it on the line, homeschoolers do put it on the line, by putting their students, their children, at the very center of their curriculum, and they make the strongest statement possible by the very act of home educating their children. So I think it is a student's first point, but it also rests upon the constitutional right also in the parents being able to make the choice of how, not if they get educated, but how they get put at the center. And I think there are other choices that parents can make in regards to the choice of public school, private school, non-public, and so on. But I think it is in that, but at all of those, I believe that all parents do have at the heart their students. Madam Chair, I again urge members for support of this bill, that as we do step into the next committee, as we've heard these testifiers, we will certainly work with you to address those concerns. And but I think, though, we have taken a measured step here at not going from high to low in a Texas model, but to going to medium. And the reason why is after 20 years of proven statistics that this population in particular has a high success rate, a proven track record, that I think they have earned that ability in working with their superintendents to lift some of these paperwork mandates that may not necessarily contribute at all to the value of the student first and the quality of that education, but in fact, by excessive regulations, put people making time and spending time doing paperwork that can otherwise be better used to the benefit of the students. So, Madam Chair, I again ask for your support for this bill, and thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer, and I know that you and Mr. Tuma will work with those who have raised concerns, and I appreciate that. And since I sit on the Committee on Education Finance, we look forward to hearing those changes and more discussion on this bill. With that, Representative Myra moves to
renews your motion
to pass House File 355 as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. All those in favor signify by saying yes. Yes. Those opposed say no.
Okay. No.
Let's try this again. Representative Myra renews her motion that House File 355, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say yes.
Yes.
Yes. Those opposed say no.
No.
And the bill is re-referred. It is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Signify by saying aye or yes.
Right, exactly.
I thought you wanted to say yes.
It's okay. I'm not old.
Yes. No, it's going to be.
Can just shove them in here. Sorry, I'm really sorted to them. Somebody else.
Thank you, committee members. We're going to start the next bill, and the chair would like to introduce her bill, but before we do that, I just want to say I think our chair has developed a new method for voting. The eyes and the nose can shout at the same time, and whoever sounds hoes the loudest, I think that will save us a lot of time. The legislative process has been changed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Madam Chair, please introduce
yourself. Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move before the committee House File 511, recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. And with that, Madam Chair, I will walk members through the bill. We certainly will not finish it today, so look forward to hearing more of this on Tuesday. There is, of course, controversy surrounding mandate relief, as we've just learned, and this is more mandate relief. All of these provisions, members, have been brought forth by superintendents and school boards, and in some cases, even parents. So let's begin with amending 120B.023, subdivision 2, which is a bit of language that takes me back to the year before I began serving. In 1997, this legislative body had the commissioner come before this committee to review the profile of learning. And at that point, then, that decision was made to move forth with that as our primary instrument for classroom learning. Then, when I began to serve after 1998, and we repealed the profile of learning, and we moved into adopting standards, we did require that the commissioner come before us to present the standards. We began with language arts, then we moved into math, social studies, and science. And so in light of what the process was then, I have added language here that would again require the commissioner to come before us before moving forward with changes in our academic standards. So that's the language that you see before you on page one of the bill. On page two at the bottom, as most of you know, or if you didn't know, the social studies standards are up for revision. It's been that long since we adopted our first standards. And my intent is to push forward the adoption of the new social studies standards for a couple of reasons. We are in the midst of discussions about to what extent our social studies standards are serving our students well and providing our teachers with a comprehensive view of American history, United States history, geography, economics, and civics education. And I do have Beth Ani here from the department to address this. I am sure this section is going to be up for debate, and I welcome that input. But as you can see, the dates have been moved forward. And as I also said, we will hear from Beth Ani from the department, and I want her to be able to speak today because I know that she is very, very busy at the department, and she also has an ill husband, and I don't want her taking time away from him. The next section of the bill amends 123A.16, and this is to allow our school boards to conduct meetings either via video or audio link. We've moved into the 21st century with technology, and I think that maybe this is time for allowing that, and this is permissive, remember, allowing that change. The next section is amending 123B.02 subdivision 15, which has never been discussed in education policy. This was placed in the pension bill. And the change here that school boards have asked for is that they be able to determine the number of available vendors under the fact that they can offer 403Bs for their employees. The next section, section 4, is amending 124D.19, and it is allowing districts, I'm changing the district population from 2,000 to 10,000 to allow some flexibility for the hiring of a community education director. Then we go on to Section 5, which is the reason this goes to government operations, rulemaking. There is so much discussion going on around here about our special education rules and laws exceeding that of the federal. And so to ensure that we know what's going on in the department with those discussions and also with our parents, that there are no changes made unless we receive unless the department receives specific legislation authority. Of course, technical changes, you know, if there are changes in wording, we want to exempt that, of course, from this change. But otherwise, this would be an important rulemaking change. Then on to Section 6, the safe school levies, which you have heard if you serve on the Finance Committee, but have not heard here. And I will have Representative Depke address that when we start hearing testimony. Section 7 is a temporary suspension of the staff development set aside. And that also has been around a time or two. And Section 8 is a bold move, and it's probably one that I am still a little uncomfortable with, but it would put the commissioner in charge of approving requests, and the commissioner must approve these requests for fund transfers, and there are conditions. If the transfer does not exceed state aid obligations, the commissioner will grant this fund transfer. Or if this fund transfer would not result in additional property tax authority to the district, the commissioner must then approve those two. The board then would approve the fund transfer after adopting a resolution. That is a bold move for us, and I certainly look forward to the discussion on that. And finally, the Section 9 repealer is the January 15th deadline. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions. And I think I would like to start with bringing Beth Ani to the table so that she can talk from the department's perspective about Section 1.
Yes. Also, would the author like to have all of her testifiers at once and the questions, or would you like to
Madam Chair, I think in light of the fact that we're going to continue this into next Tuesday, we'll take a section at a time, and if we need to go back to sections, we'll do that as well.
Very good.
This is mandate relief, and we know that with mandate relief come a lot of questions, and I want you to ask those questions. So welcome, Ms. Ani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and representatives. And thank you for the invitation. I'm Beth Ani. I'm Director of Academic Standards and P20 Initiatives at the Department of Education. I'm really pleased to be able to share with you this morning some basic information about the process that we use in our state to revise the required academic standards. As Madam Chair indicated, we are in the process of revising the state's K-12 social studies standards. That process has been underway since January, and we expect to have the final draft sent to the commissioner of the revised standards in mid-May. School districts would be required to implement the revised standards in the 2013-14 school year. So the schedule that has been set up in legislation is typically one subject area per year gets revised, followed by 2 years of school districts adjusting to those new standards and then implementing them two years after they've been developed. Basically, in Minnesota, I think we have a very thoughtful, very deliberative process for establishing these statewide expectations. And this is a process that has been informed by the state's participation in different kinds of initiatives sponsored by ACHIEVE and also the American Diploma Project, a key initiative of ACHIEVE. And through our participation in the American Diploma Project, we've had increased focus on college and career readiness skills as a necessary component of our standards, and then of course that aligns very well with the statute that requires us to embed college and career readiness in our standards. In this process, we select a committee. The commissioner selects a committee from applications that are submitted by the public. A committee is formed. The committee meets throughout a school year to develop the actual revisions to the standards. And this is followed by a very intensive period of rulemaking, in which a detailed statement of need and reasonableness is developed. We make the case for why certain changes are needed in the standards. And if the public is interested in a hearing, then a hearing ensues at that point. But the public is involved early on in the stages of the development process. And the first thing we do, this is kind of a very quick overview of how the development process works for the standards. The first thing that happens is the formation of the committee. And as I said, applications are accepted online through the Department of Education's website. The commissioner picks a committee. The committee we have for social studies is the largest standards committee that we've ever had. And this is because of the concern that people had regarding having enough subject matter expertise on the committee so that the committee could thoughtfully make all the changes that are needed in five different disciplines that comprise social studies under state statute. So we have a committee of 45 so that we can adequately cover all grade levels as well as all disciplines at those grade levels. In addition, we have a number of experts that can help us with certain issues that need to be addressed in the social studies standards. We have experts, for example, in Indian education, because there's a statute that requires us to embed the contributions of Minnesota American Indian tribes and communities. So we need that expertise on the committee. We also have expertise related to financial literacy and personal finance, because again, the public has expressed a great interest in beefing up, if you will, to use a real professional term, beefing up the standards for personal financial literacy. So it's important for students to have good understanding of macro and microeconomic concepts, but it even goes beyond that. It needs to apply to their own personal financial education. So we try to get a committee that has all of this expertise. And then the process is one that involves at least nine different stages. But to give you a quick overview of how that unfolds, the committee studies a variety of documents that are of national or international significance. So they examine key reports that have been issued pertaining to social studies education of K-12 students. They look at so-called exemplary standards from other states. They look at performance of Minnesota students on exams of national and international significance, and of course those vary depending on the discipline that's under review that year. After they do that examination, they compare that information to what they see in the K-12 standards. And then a gap analysis is performed. They look to see what issues need to be further addressed in the standards, which ones are well covered, and so on. And then they begin to prioritize their list of concerns. First, we need to address this, followed by this, and so on. Right now, in social studies, we're at the beginning stages of that process. We've performed the gap analysis. They've prioritize their concerns, and they're just beginning now to complete their first draft revisions to the standards. After the committee has a first draft ready to go, the next stage is a public review and comment period. And during this period, which typically lasts about a week and a half, 2 weeks, we go to different regions of the state, and we host town hall meetings. And the purpose of that is to invite the public to come share with us what they like or don't like about the proposed revisions to the standards. And the committee takes notes at these meetings. When that's all finished, when the meetings are finished, they go back to the standards committee and say, "Here's what we heard from the public." Some people aren't comfortable talking in person like that, so we also have an online feedback process. We get many, many comments submitted online that our committee can analyze as well. So all that feedback is collected and shared, and then the next draft of the standards is published. And at that point, we typically consult 3 to 7 experts that have some kind of national or international reputation in the subject area for their knowledge of standards-based education, their expertise in the content, the subject matter. And we get very detailed reports back from our experts saying what they think are the strong points as well as the weaknesses of the proposed revisions. And that's often a very sobering time for our standards committee, because sometimes we get reports that make us stop and kind of hold our breath and say, well, we have to rethink this. We really need to address some things that we didn't do very well. So another draft gets produced. Eventually, the committee produces a draft that is in its final state. That is, it has addressed all the major concerns that have been brought up by members of the community, national experts, parents, educators, and so on. And that final draft gets sent to the commissioner for approval. Or the commissioner at that point can say, there's a problem here, it needs to be fixed, and then we would need to go back and do that. After that development process has ended, the rulemaking process starts, and that typically takes anywhere from 10 or 11 months to a year and a half. It's a very, very deliberative process, again, involving much documentation and input. So in a nutshell, that's a little bit about the committee. It's a little bit about the process. As we have had in the other subject areas, there will be a number of changes to our standards, and that will require some adjustment on the part of our schools. But I have to say, to this point, our schools have responded very, very well with the changes that we've already made to the mathematics, English language arts, science, and the arts standards. So we anticipate the same will be true for the social studies standards with the changes that will occur there.
Thank you very much, Ms.
Madam
Fani.
Chair, I have a question for Ms. Fani.
Yes.
Are the visits now that you'll begin, are they a part of the Chapter 14 rulemaking?
Madam Chair, yes, they are.
So then, Madam Chair, I think that Ms. Ani and I will be having discussions about some of these dates that I've pushed forward, because if the process she has explained is part of rulemaking, that comes as a package, and there, then I think we should discuss, though schools are very, superintendents and school boards are very concerned about the cost of this, how we would probably back off some of my advance dates. But I think you and I need to talk about that before next Tuesday. But I don't want her to have to stay to answer questions of mine, but I just needed to get that clarified in front of the committee, whether the visit now that where they collect the information in and prepare the second draft, third draft, and so on is part of Chapter 14. And if it is, then we can discuss changing these dates.
Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank
and it's
you.
And what I heard you say is that we will continue next, after you speak with Ms. Ani, we will continue working on Section 1. At this time, we do have 3 questions that I believe are from Ms. Ani. Is that all right with you, the author?
Absolutely, yes.
All right, very good. The first person is Representative Carlos Mariani that would like to ask a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have 3 questions. Hopefully they'll go relatively quick. Commissioner Ani, so you laid out very quickly here what apparently is a pretty thorough process that's been kind of standardized at the department for over several years of a heavy engagement with the public. So you have a transparency, piece there. That speaks to, I think, some ownership issues on the part of the public. And embedded in there is you're accessing, experts in the field in the form of these committees. So my 3 questions are, the first one is, can you tell us how do Minnesota standards stack up nationally in terms of quality? Are we generally considered a low quality standard setting state? Are we considered a high quality? Just give us a sense or a feel, because part of what we attempt to do, I think, in legislation is to address issues and problems. And I guess I'm trying to get at what the issue or the problem is in regards to this particular section. So I want to get a sense of what the context is here. So how do our standards stack up nationally in terms of quality?
Madam Chair, Representative, it depends on who you ask, but overall, Minnesota is generally highly regarded for its standards and the education delivered by its schools. When I say it depends on who you ask, there are a couple organizations, at least a couple, that rate states on the quality of their standards. The problem with these rating systems is that they use differing criteria. And sometimes these criteria do not agree with the philosophy that's been set forth in statute for a state standards. So, for example, two organizations that come to mind are the American Federation of Teachers and the Fordham Foundation, the Fordham Institute. Both of them issue state ratings on their standards. Fordham Foundation, for example, has a key criterion that standards must be grade level specific. So we have never earned a good grade from Fordham Foundation, because until we started revising standards, we always had grade banded standards. We didn't have grade level specific standards. But that has changed with each time that we revised the state standards. So the most recent report is Fordham, which came out just very recently, and they gave us a C in our history standards, and largely that's because we don't have grade level specific standards. That will be one of the big changes that will happen when we revise the social studies standards this year, because state statute does require it. But in terms of coherence of our state standards documents, in terms of their clarity, provided by a hierarchy of standards, benchmarks, and illustrative examples, in terms of the depth of rigor that's required in the various subject areas, Minnesota is generally considered to have very high quality standards. So that's a very good thing, very good thing. Again, there's always room for improvement, but depending on who's doing the evaluating, we get, you know, different kinds of rating. When the Common Core standards were kicked off, about 2 years ago, Minnesota was invited to be a key player in that effort. So we had members who were on both of the ELA and mathematics writing teams for Common Core.
Madam Chair, so then
Representative Mariani
and Ms. Sani, so it sounds like generally good quality to high quality, moving in the right direction, going forward. And I'm familiar with the Common Core discussion. We had hearings on that in the last couple of years, and as I've shared with members here in past committee hearings, state of Minnesota even, and this was actually a bipartisan, I think, position, yes, basically said, you know, we're not comfortable with where the Common Core math standard is headed at this point, because we think we have a better approach. We have a higher quality approach. And so I'm comforted to know that generally speaking, we've got a really good framework of standards, and I think that speaks to the process, quite frankly, engaged here. And so on the process issue, what would be your sense of ownership by educators in the state of Minnesota of our current standards? Do we have standards that educators simply don't own, that they sort of begrudge, that they feel are an imposition, that have it included their wisdom or perspective? Are you hearing those kind of? I mean, there's always someone that can complain about anything, but I mean, generally speaking, are you perceiving So the department perceiving a problem there that needs to be addressed in regards to this ownership by Minnesota's educators?
Ms. Hani.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I'm not perceiving a problem in that area. In fact, just the opposite. I think our experience, well, I'll speak with experience overall in all the subject areas for standards development and then social studies specifically, but since we started revising standards in any area, and that started with mathematics in 2006-2007 school year, since we started that, we have made very deliberate attempts to involve the expertise of K-12 educators and college instructors who are knowledgeable about the kinds of entering knowledge and skills that students need to be successful in post-secondary. And since we made attempts to involve them very deliberately in the committee work and the analysis and so on, I think we not only improved the quality of the standards document, but also that really helped with ownership as well. So it's really, really, really important to involve the expertise of these educators in the writing process. It's also very important to involve community members and parents. Many, many people need to be included in this process, and that's why it gets a little messy at times, but I think the key is when certain groups need to be involved and making sure that the process allows for that involvement, for that input at different intervals. So I think we've got that worked out. I think there's good ownership, despite the fact that we've had some rather big changes in our standards, and I could give you many examples. Mathematics, grade 8, algebra, defining algebra 2 for all students as a requirement for graduation. In science, adding a whole new K-12 progression on engineering design, one of the first states in the nation to do that. In English language arts, building in a very robust media literacy kind of requirement, again, because college and career readiness indicates it, but the Common Core standards lack that piece, even though we adopted Common Core. In the arts, making sure that students are familiar with five arts areas and a variety of processes and foundational knowledge. All of these were rather groundbreaking kinds of changes for standards in K-12 education in our state, but the schools faced with these challenges, I think, have done a remarkable job getting their teachers and staff updated with professional development and the kinds of knowledge and skills they need to make this happen for all students. We're never always there, quite there, but that's our goal, and I think the ownership is a big part of this. I think that's part of the reason that schools have been able to meet those challenges.
Thank you, Ms. Ani. Members, we are at the zero hour for this committee. We have two more testifiers, two more people that would like to ask questions. Would the author allow them to ask Ms. Ani to come back at our meeting on Tuesday, if that's all right, with Representative Greiling, Representative Norton, and if the testifier can be here on Tuesday, they can ask their questions at that time. Is that acceptable? Yes, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question actually was for Representative Erickson, so I don't need Ms. Ani for
good.
My question.
All right, thank you. Representative Norton?
Sure, I'll try to make this quick. This is a non-underlined part of the legislation, and I'm just going to lay it out here and then see if it needs addressing. And that is line 2.3, students must satisfactorily complete an Algebra 1 credit by the end of the eighth grade. This is in progress for this year. I have just heard from some superintendents in my area where students have failed first semester Algebra 1. They are now in the situation where the students have failed the first semester. They're sending them on to second semester having failed the first semester. They'll either pass them on just to get them out without perhaps the rigor that one would expect, or they're going to have to do summer remediation, which will be a cost to the district. I think this was kind of one of these unintended outcomes that we have right now, right in the middle of the year, dealing with these kids. But they're either going to have to try to teach them one and two in the same semester, and as we know, mathematics is you build upon a foundation, and when you fail the first foundation, it's going to be really tough to get these kids having successfully completed Algebra 1 by the end of this year without some sort of intervention during the summer. So I'm wondering if we need to look at this a little bit, or if there's something we can be doing to address it, or I know funding is tough, so I don't suspect we'll be able to give them a lot of money for this, but just wondered your thoughts.
Thank you, Representative Norton, and I've shared that with Ms. Ani, and so we'll talk in between now and next Tuesday, and she will return. I know she's very busy, and you need to know that Beth Ani does excellent work at the department on our academic standards, and had I known that she was so far into the revisions, I probably would have done something different with this language, but we'll work it out. So thank you, Madam Chair, and we'll address this on Tuesday.
Thank you, members, and we will see you then and continue this with Ms. Ani on Tuesday. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.